And good morning to everyone. Our first case today is Doe versus McCoy. Mr. Friedman, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning. May I please the court, counsel? Appellant respectfully submits that the retroactive application of the current statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse cases does not violate the Due Process Clause of Nebraska's Constitution. The time period prescribed by Section 25228 is a rational response by the legislature to exceptional circumstances and potential for injustice faced by adults who fell victim to childhood sexual abuse. That's a finding echoed by the Connecticut Supreme Court in Doe versus Hartford Roman Catholic Diocese. Even if the court chooses to continue barring barred causes of action as vested property rights, those rights should not be regarded as absolute. The rational basis test employed by several courts, including Wisconsin and I believe New York, would allow for a measured approach to this very specific piece of legislation. We would submit that even a strict scrutiny test would be satisfied by the current statute insofar as the legislature's response is very narrowly tailored to a very compelling interest. As amicus curiae has noted, victims of childhood sexual abuse are prone to dysfunction and compulsive behaviors, substance abuse problems, tendencies to deny and delegitimize their own traumatic experiences, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and depression.
Counsel, could you tell us a little bit more about the measured approach that other states have taken? What did you mean with that phrase?
Well, in Wisconsin and in New York, there is a recognition that there is some kind of substantive property right in a barred case. And those states use the rational basis test or some variant thereof in order to measure the competing interests and determine whether the alleged constitutional violation is acceptable in light of the interests advanced and the manner in which those interests are.
How does one measure, what criteria would one measure in that sort of approach?
Well, as the U.S. Supreme Court has noted and other states have noted in evaluating these constitutional claims, you create a balancing test and you create a mechanism by which the interests are balanced. I think a rational basis test would be appropriate, and we've got a rational response to an important governmental interest. I think verbiage like that could be used in a variety of cases, and certainly in this case it would show that the statute should be construed as constitutional because this is really a rational response, it's reasonable, and it's governmental interest, which makes sense to further.
So as I understand it, that approach would allow the legislature to pick and choose which sorts of claims could be treated as not barred by the statute of limitations, even though it had run.
I think so. I mean, those statutes would always obviously be amenable to review by...
So we're not going to let it happen for contract cases, but we will for egregious torts, maybe not for slips and falls, but you're suggesting the legislature should be the place to draw that line, but how do they draw that line?
Well, I think they would do it by hearing testimony in committee, legislative findings, and creating a record, just like every state who uses this kind of test does, just like the Congress does. When they're passing statutes that arguably violate constitutional interests, this is the kind of thing that's happened for decades in our country. So, and I'm not speaking to contract cases or garden variety torts. Obviously, I'm talking about the instant case and sexual abuse cases. So I think certainly a rational basis standard if this court would choose to adopt such a standard would be satisfied.
So do you think the legislature has already done that here?
I think there are some findings in the legislature, given the text of the statute on its face, that this is a reasonable response to an important governmental interest, yes.
Did they purport to speak to retroactive effect by any express words?
it says notwithstanding any other provision of law. That's what the statute says, and the case law says that the statute of limitations is the one that is, the statute of limitations to be applied is the one applicable.
Would the reference to other provision of law include a constitutional provision?
I would argue yes. I think the legislature knew it. It's the law. I think even Appley would argue that by the plain application of the statute in this case, it's not time barred. You have to revert to case law and the manner in which this court has interpreted Nebraska's due process clause in contravention of the identical clause in the U.S. Supreme Court in order to arrive at the result that the district court adopted. So I don't think that's the just result, and I think that this court should revisit the issue in light of the really specific and exceptional circumstances at play in sexual abuse cases and the way in which sister states have also evaluated this kind of problem.
Some of the somewhat similar laws actually have language purporting to apply it retroactively, which would revive time-barred cases, right?
I think so, yes.
But this statute, the one that you're pointing to, doesn't have that language in the legislation.
I can't make up words that aren't in the statute.
Right. So you're starting, there's a lot of places to start, perhaps, that it would be ordinarily statutes of limitations are those that are in place at the time of and so forth, right?
Yes, the statute of limitations that is in place at the time of filing of laws.
Right. Okay. And is it, are statutes of limitations treated as procedural or substantive?
They are treated normally as procedural, and I think there's this confusing discrepancy in the law when statutes of limitations and whether they're retroactive apply to plaintiffs versus defendants. This court has said in Prattville and other cases that changes to statutes of limitations in the retroactive application are procedural because they merely affect remedies. And so it's okay. It's not a big deal. But
they merely affect remedies.
Yes. But on the other hand, they've said, this court has said in Givens in the cases cited by Appellees, that a barred statute of limitations, a case that's barred by statute of limitations, affects a substantive vested property right. And that, of course, is contrary to the Campbell versus Fulton case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Chase case that cites Campbell, and many other states that follow that. There's
so you referred to Doe, which has a compendium, a 50-state survey, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the states are somewhat split, without going into the details. And then you find New York and Wisconsin as having their own method of jurisprudence with respect to this issue. Am I right?
Yes.
And so where, with the states that, such as Nebraska in Givens, your view is we kind of went off the rails there. Would you tell us why?
Because it's an absolute bar. So the court says this is a vested property right, and basically
in the defendant.
Yes, and there's it can never be violated no matter what. And in constitutional jurisprudence, we never say that these rights are absolute and can never ever be violated by the government for any reason. I mean, even the most fundamental rights that are inherent in our concept of ordered liberty are allowed to be violated if strict scrutiny is applied. So that's, I think the court should adopt some kind of test by which these really critically important legislative issues can be determined to not violate constitutional rights. I'll reserve what little time I have left.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excuse me.
Mr. Davis, good morning to you.
Counsel, my name is James Martin Davis. I represent William Bryce Bruce McCoy, who is, that's the name of the real party of interest. I see since the last time I've been here, there are three new faces on the court, so I want to congratulate, postpone, at least belatedly congratulate and welcome you to the court. There are two issues, really, I think, that need to be addressed. The issue with respect to the loss of consortium I'm going to submit. But basically, what the issues are is that they failed to file an action in the name of the real party of interest. Even if you look at the catch, and now it's still Doe versus McCoy. It shouldn't be Doe versus McCoy. That's a fictitious name. You know, this is a public court. The district court is a public court. They should have filed it in the name of the real party in interest. That's jurisdictional. The second issue is the fact that it's pretty clear that the plaintiff's claim was time barred in this instance. I mean, by case law and by statute. And so what we're asking the court to do is affirm the district court with respect to both of those findings. First of all, you know, with respect to Doe versus McCoy. That's jurisdictional. There's no such thing as being able to file a fictitious name unless you go to the court and you get permission to do so. And then there has to be extraordinary or some kind of important reasons to allow somebody to file an action in a fictitious name.
Doesn't the statute require that before a case is dismissed for that reason, that the parties be given an opportunity to substitute?
Well, yes, but...
Was that done here?
What was done here is the plaintiff circumvented that by going around and giving a secret letter to the judge with respect to the issue about who the real party of interest is. I mean, Judge, I think it's jurisdictional with respect to getting approval from the court to do that. But I mean, even again, I quarrel with that because the idea that this is a sensitive case and so you need to get permission to do file an action in the name of a plaintiff flies in the face of equal justice. Well, why can't a defendant say the same thing? It's the same action.
Could the defendant do the same thing?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that they could, but it's too late once the cat's out of the bag.
Did the defendant take any steps? Or are you saying that the way it is filed, you can't unring the bell?
That's exactly right. You know, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, I just really quarrel with this idea that you could file an action under a fictitious name unless there should be some kind of extraordinary circumstances, because it slanders the defendant and it protects any kind of slanderous, libelous actions on the part of the plaintiffs. You can't presume that somebody is accurate and somebody who files a suit is automatically going to prevail, that what they say is the truth, because that what you're doing by allowing them to do that is saying, oh, this is a sensitive interest. You know, you're maybe going to prevail because you were a child or because you were a woman or because, you know, you were mentally incompetent or whatever. Well, we're going to protect you. Where does that notion come from? I don't see anything in the Constitution or the statutes other than some of the rules that even empower this kind of notion. You know, these are courts of law. Actions have to be public. There has to be transparency there. And I quarrel with this idea, unless there's some kind of extraordinary circumstances, that you can file an action in a fictitious name. We don't, there's such thing as legal fictions, but not in terms of the parties, because you're presuming that the plaintiff is right and the defendant's wrong.
Counsel, can't we point to a long list of cases, reported opinions from this court involving Doe parties?
Well, yes.
And if that's true, then how does your argument impact that?
Well, that's the Orr case, if you're talking about there, and we're dealing with children there. I mean, in the Orr case, somebody was a child, and here we have somebody who's no longer a child. Their action is based on the fact that they were supposedly injured when they're children, but they're not now. They're adults. And so what I'm saying in this instance is that the judge was right by dismissing the case on the basis of the fact that it was not filed in the name of the real party of interest. And the second issue has to do with time bar. They're asking you to adopt a Lazarus principle to bring this case back from the dead. I mean, it was over. It was done with. It was time barred. And I don't care what kind of cases that they say from other jurisdictions, but you have to look at the idea of what the law is all about. The individual in this case had a case that was time barred. The actions took place in 1991, age of 6, allegedly. It was a 4-year statute of limitations. It was told until she was turned 21. She turned 21 in September of 2006, so she had until September of 2010 to file it. She did, so it was time barred. All right, now, without regard to the statutes, we have to look at the fundamental way we approach the law, going all the way to Blackstone. We have to deal with what we call fundamental fairness. When we have, this is in the nature of an ex post facto law. We don't allow those. Why?
Has the legislature spoken on this? Have they said something that would allow this to be revived?
I don't think at all. There's nothing in the statutes. If the legislature wanted to do that, they could have done it, and they didn't. And then perhaps, at least in this issue, we wouldn't be here, or we might be here arguing the unconstitutionality.
Do you think that our opinion in Givens is correctly decided?
Well, Givens and Shent, both of those cases, I think, are right. And we just had the same case,
so
another case in federal court.
So the in the states, and there's a division of authority in the states. I'll just say, I
not
think
in this state, federal.
No, amongst the states, right, amongst the states rather than the federal system. And in the states that say no vested right for the defendant, they say, for example, the defendant's interest in the limitations defense is procedural rather than substantive. In cases not involving claims to real property, the running of the applicable limitations period bars only the legal remedy while leaving the underlying cause of action unaffected. So that's one of the states that differs from Nebraska, essentially no vested right, therefore retroactive is okay.
Well, and they ignore the concept of finality.
That's my question, is what is wrong with the reasoning of those states?
Because it flies in the face of the idea of finality. It flies in the face of, remember, equity and the remedy of the defense of latches, about ex post facto. Our whole case law, our whole history of American Anglo-American jurisdictions rings with the idea of fundamental fairness, and it's fundamentally unfair to say, okay, now, my friend, you know, your case was time-barred, but all of a sudden now, in the interest of some political interest, or because children are involved, we're going to say, no, you know, what you thought was final is now no longer final. I don't even know if in my mind, legislature has the right to do that jurisdictionally, because I think there are constitutional arguments there, because, you know, this is...
If the legislature inserted this new statute of limitations as retroactive in the legislation, then what would your argument be?
It would be constitutional, but we would be here as the appellate rather than the appellee.
Did you say it would be constitutional or unconstitutional?
No, I think it's unconstitutional application. Because what they...
Oh, wait, help, I'm follow, trying to follow. If the legislature, in the precise language of the statute, were to say, here's a lengthy new statute of limitations, and it's retroactive, would that be a constitutional piece of legislation?
I would be in this court asking to overturn that on the grounds that it's unconstitutional, because it denies somebody fundamental fairness. You know, its effect, you know, that's why we have the doctrine of latches. That's why we don't have ex post facto laws. All you have to do is look at Blackstone's commentary laws going back to the 16th century. That's what the law is all about. It's not about reviving statute of limitations. It's about giving and delving out and meeting out just to the parties. And how can you, in good conscience, say, okay, your case is over and you're done with, but now all of a sudden, boom, that destroys the whole idea in the law, consistency, uniformity, and predictability. That's what the law is all about. You know, that's why we have this doctrine of finality. And so what I'm suggesting to you is we follow the law in this state and this law that Judge Girard in federal court just ruled on just this last year and uphold the decision of the district court.
Was he applying state or federal law in that decision?
State.
Counsel, before you sit down, what meaning do you attribute to the phrase notwithstanding any other provision of law under 25-228? What's the meaning of that introductory phrase?
I don't know.
Are you asking us to overlook those or to...
No, no, I'm just saying that they...
Then what meaning do you attribute to those words?
I give it no meaning. I mean, it's ambiguous. If they wanted to say we're going to make it retroactive, they could. Now, that doesn't say it's going to be retroactive, so I don't know what kind of logic or words you're going to have to breathe in that phrase, but it's going to be trying to take a little balloon that's empty of air and blow it up, because that's not what it says. There's nothing by notwithstanding. That's ambiguous at best, and so I don't give it any meaning, and I don't think that you ladies and gentlemen should either.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute
and 20 seconds, Mr. Friedman.
Statutes of limitations are arbitrary. Going back to Campbell versus Holt, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Due Process Clause as not giving vested property rights or substantive due process rights to defendants who have time-barred claims against them. I mean, the entire Due Process Clause is a creation of, and the manner in which it's interpreted is a creation of our courts, our Supreme Court, our state courts, our sister courts, and I submit that there's no good reason, no principled reason to blow up that balloon in Mr. Davis's language and say that a time-barred claim is a substantive property right that can never, ever be violated under any circumstances. That just flies in the face of our constitutional tradition.
Have we already said that in Gibbons?
I think that has been said in Gibbons, Your Honor. I'm asking the court to revisit Gibbons. And moreover, like I said before, I don't think there's a principled reason to treat statutes of limitations as procedural and just affecting remedies when applied to plaintiffs, that is new statutes of limitations, but they're substantive and a completely different animal when applied to defendants with time-barred cases. I just don't think that's fair, and I think the court should address that issue as well. As for the real party in interest, at the very least, the district court should have allowed an amendment. That would have been the fairest thing.
Counsel, before you sit down, as I heard the decision from another state that Judge Miller-Lerman was reciting from, it said except for cases involving real estate. Is real estate a meaningful distinction in this instance?
Well, it's tough for me to address that because real estate isn't an issue in this case. But what I would say off the cuff, Judge, Your Honor, is that if you have real property, your expectations with respect to that real property rely more on the finality of a decision. And so I think there's some sense in which your real property at issue, that's closer to our fundamental concepts of ordered liberty as opposed to getting away with abusing a child.
So in the, this is a tort, this particular case, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in the real estate area, there are plenty of provisions that require registration in the clerk and the county and everything, so everybody knows what's going on with this real property.
I think that's true. I'm going to struggle with property law, though, Your Honor.
I just used a generic register something with somebody. Okay.
I agree.
To give notice as to the status,
yes,
of real property.
That's a fair point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case.